I just instantly thought something wrong with the kids.
Oh my god. So you just started sounding like a perfect match robot. Tonight on the Balls Podcast After Dark, we have Dexter from Perfect Match.
Oh, Jesus.
Not the best.
What was his name? What was the guy's name? Greg Evans.
Greg Evans, yes. So I heard that he's a marriage celebrant now.
So
now he can marry the people who get compatibility ratings of 79%.
No, it's going to be 69%, isn't it?
That would be nice.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Dinner for two?
Are you able to record at your end?
I can't, no.
No, that's all right. We'll run with it. You know, even if it sounds a bit gravelly, we'll sort it out in post.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, you're all right. You're breaking up a bit, but we'll figure it out. If it's entirely terrible,
we'll blame Malcolm Turnbull.
Yeah, we'll blame the entirety of Australia, basically. Just the fucking general state of everything.
The general gist. The vibe.
Yes, Marbo. Yeah, blame Eddie Marbo.
Actually, was there a soundtrack for that? I think there must have been.
For Marbo?
There must have.
Oh, for the castle.
For the castle.
Yeah, probably. I mean, there was bound to be. Although Working Dog never really put their hand in their pocket to get, you know, to get too much action going.
Yeah, no, they probably wouldn't have. And it would have been something dodgy anyway. Although there was. There was an on-screen soundtrack.
Was that just incidental music that they commissioned, or was that...
I don't know. It's not coming up on anything. There's a CD for it. It's got the Champs, Bread, Captain and Tennille.
Oh, my... That's awesome. This sounds. I think I'm going to have to clear my schedule. This sounds like it should have been number one on my list. Fuck everything else off.
Revised time. Yes, Kate Sobrano. There you go. We've only just begun. That was the song. That was the key song. I did listen to your last week's episode just yesterday. So I've got the gist of it.
So basically, we haven't talked at any stage in this great long fucking After Dark journey about soundtracks, mainly because most of them are not made by one band, you know. Because the whole conceit behind the After Dark was the album is dying, but we still felt there was a place for the album as a statement by a band or a group of creatives or an artist at that time, at that place in their career, about where they were, more than just individual songs can sort of say that. It's sort of a soundtrack. In a way, it's like that, but the people doing the curating are different. Sometimes it's the movie people. Sometimes it's sometimes you've got an individual band that's doing all the work. And also they have this cool thing with what they used to do in the 90s, where sometimes the soundtrack was its own project over and above the movie itself. And some of those have lived on longer than some of the movies themselves, like Judgment Night and Spawn and so on and so forth. So we've just been interested to sort of get in and talk about what movie soundtracks are memorable and why they're memorable and why they're cool. So, and we thought we'd get our semi-regular music correspondents in to have a bit of a chat, and we'll have a chat to Adam, and we thought we'd have a chat to you as well.
Yeah, great. Well, I mean, I think all of mine have sort of fit that general gist of it being either one artist or a statement of art in its own right.
Yeah.
Over and above the movie itself. Yeah. I think all apart from one were actually commissioned for the movie itself. I think that the earliest one I've got is the Blues Brothers.
Yes.
Which is the original one. I think Adam had the 2000 one. Is that right?
Adam did not have the 2000 one. That was a little joke that Bezo and I played on Adam. And
right.
I don't think he knew that was a joke that we thought. Did you know that you actually got that wrong? And we said, yes, I do know that we got that wrong.
Right.
Well, I thought the giveaway was that we dissolved in laughter after we finished the bit.
No, I didn't get the joke. I didn't get the,
oh, great. We need to signpost our jokes a lot more strongly, near as I can tell.
Well, I think...
We fucked up. We needed to flag that one.
I've got the original Blues Brothers in my list. It's probably it's the earliest one I've got, I think, so it's the oldest one I've got.
It's 1980, I believe.
Was that old?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about that is that a lot of those acts at the time were actually, they were long past peak. They were kind of washed up. You know, they were people who'd been bigger in the 60s and 70s. So for a lot of them, it was a bit of a comeback.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, for me, it was one that I had to come back to because it was tainted by school band, bad memories of trying to do, was it the Peter Gunn theme? And we didn't do Rawhide, but there was another song in there that we tried to do as well, which, you know, when you're in school bands, they tend to devolve into stupidity after a while. So
yes.
That one I put away. But then just by chance, I was in Japan this time last year and a half ago, I think it was. And they're really big on CDs in Japan. Like, it's still? Little, yeah, massively so. Like, they don't do streaming there at all, really. Well,
is that because of rights or because of lack of internet? I mean, I don't imagine it's because of lack of signal for the internet. I imagine they're pretty well Wi-Fi.
No. I think the general myth that Japan is technologically advanced is slowly being debunked. But I think they only got Spotify in the last couple of years, and it really hasn't been taken off. They don't do streaming movies at all. It's all pay TV and NHK, but it just comes down to,
I suppose, vending machines as well.
Yeah, to an extent, but it's really physical media. I mean, physical media, you buy CDs everywhere, you buy DVDs, you know, magazines, books, bookstores and you know, newspaper stores are massive in Japan.
Sounds like my kind of place. I really miss physical media, I have to admit.
Yeah, yeah. And it comes from just the fact that the concept of jobs for life, and the guys that are in charge of these companies now have been there for 30, 40 years. They're now executives at Sony Music, for example. And all they know and all they're confident in is the medium that they were trained in. And so they're naturally quite suspicious of anything new coming along. So
they're kind of institutionally conservative with their choices. But is there any kind of stratification by demographic? I mean, the young kids coming through still wanting to read printed words and listen to hard media magazines? Because I would have thought they would have. I could see why, you know, we've seen young kids come through and almost ironically adopt physical media like vinyl, kind of reclaim it in an ironic sense, in a kind of a gentrifying sense. But it's not that at all. They've just never left it in the first place.
No, and I think that, generally, Japanese society is quite conservative in itself. So even the kids, obviously, you've got different levels. Being a country of 130 million, or two rather large metropolises would have a fairly large chunk of people that would dwarf our population in terms of people that take on digital media and streaming, but the vast majority. I mean, you go to country towns, you go to little cities, and you have these things called book off, which are second hand bookstores, and they're really like, they're not vinnies, they're not dusty old crusty shops. They're franchise shops that people dump their old CDs and books and magazines and all that sort of stuff in. And I picked up one last year. It was Blues Brothers, the original one, in the old jewel case.
Oh, nice.
And it would have been from 1981, I think it was.
Oh, so it would have been the, so not even a remaster. It would have been the original CD release.
The original. Jesus, and that was our sort of soundtrack. That and I picked up Jamiroquai's first album, and bizarrely enough, Sekiden from Brisbane. I found theirs in a secondhand bookstore in country Japan.
Holy shit!
They were our soundtracks for driving around the rice fields and the snow fields last year.
That would have been awesome fun. I've always had a lot of time for secondhand bookstores and secondhand CD stores is how I filled my CD collection as a broke art student. So
that's
part of the reason I'm sad to see the passing, if you like, of physical media in Australia, New Zealand, and let's say the West broadly. Is because it had a tactile quality to it, and you could rediscover gems, and you could discover versions of stuff that predated the nice polished shiny version. I mean, if you wanted to find a weird Japanese release of a certain album, you're not going to find it in the Spotify era. You're going to find the one version that's on Spotify.
Yeah, exactly. And so the Blues Brothers for me, I mean, that album is just you know, it's old soul and rock standards. Yeah. And
done by the original artists.
Yeah. So. But the Peter Gunn thing, for me, is just timeless. Rawhide, you can't beat Rawhide in terms of sheer sort of tongue in cheek piss take. In terms of that you put yourself in that mode of watching the movie whenever that song comes on.
Yeah.
And it's on high rotation.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that the song we put on to sort of try to underline the joke we were trying to pull that obviously didn't land was, we found that in Blues Brothers 2000, it was basically all the same jokes done not as well. And they'd used Ghost Riders in the Sky as their equivalent of Rawhide. And they did this kind of slow, loping, Cletus-driven version of that. And that was the song that we bedded under our discussion of allegedly Adam's favourite song.
Awesome.
It did not work. Did not land. But that was the kind of thing about
it. Hey, could just be me. Could just be me.
It was Adam too. So nobody got that joke. So we thought we were so clever. Anyway, but yeah, Blues Brothers and I mean, the thing about Blues Brothers and my favourite pick, Spinal Tap, both Saturday Night Live spin-offs. And yeah, Saturday Night Live spin-offs have had a long history of churning out really interesting soundtrack material.
Well, who else is in there? Like, who else is in that sort of mode? I don't know.
Wayne's World?
Yes, that was on my long list.
Yeah, Soul to Squeeze was on the Conehead soundtrack.
Yeah.
Night of the Roxbury, I think, had a soundtrack that was well thought of. So there's quite a few of that kind of Saturday Night Live sketch made into movie, and not a lot of these movies were necessarily great, but
a lot
of them, you know, that they had something coming out of that was quite useful.
Look, I've tried to go back and listen to watch all these movies again, and I'm struggling, to be honest. I've tried it twice since coming back from Japan and having a soundtrack, and I just get halfway through it and I was going, this is just not me anymore.
Well, the pacing of a movie like that is kind of tough because, I mean, it is a little bit glacial with the pacing. There are some fantastic moments in that movie, but it takes a while to kind of circumnavigate them.
Yeah, exactly.
But it could be worse. It could be Blues Brothers 2000. Which was genuinely fucking awful. Oh, it's
bad. I've never seen it.
Don't watch it. Just watch Blues Brothers, the original, and just imagine the jokes it was.
So the second on my list is exactly the same. I mean, it's pretty much Blues Brothers of 1991, which is the Commitment soundtrack.
Good shout.
It's just the same band. It's the band that does. So the movie itself is the soundtrack. So
yes. So it's a bit like Spinal Tap in that respect.
Without the piss tape. I think maybe there's a joke there that I'm missing too, but the Commitments is sort of downtrodden working class kids in Dublin.
Yeah, sort of Billy Elliot, but with a soul band.
And the guy who leads that, Andrew Strong, has got this gravelly, amazing voice, and that's the whole point of the movie. You know, these good for nothings that will obviously spend their life on the dole or going to jail. Strap on a guitar and sing old blues and soul.
Mustang standard. Sally. Yeah.
Mustang Sally is absolutely great song.
Well, yeah, that's the version of Mustang Sally that I know the best because that was, 1991, that was, well, fucking 13, I suppose. That's the defining, that is the archetypal fucking version of, that's the prototype version of Mustang Sally I know is the Commitments version because that was a hit when I was a young teenager.
And that
boy could howl. He could fucking howl his ass off.
Still does, and he still actually travels around with that. So the guy Andrew Strong is his name. He puts together a band every now and then called The Commitments, and he tours around and just does that album basically. I think there was a second soundtrack as well, which wasn't as good, but he's forged a career.
Did they do a sequel? Was it a sequel album or a sequel movie?
I think a sequel album. I think the album, the
there was no sequel
band.
Movie. There was no Commitments to Commit Harder or anything like that.
Commit More. No, they
Electric Commit Malou
got back together and did another album. So not as great, but this one's got the tie in with the movie. So, but interesting sort of side note to that is the guitarist in the band in the movie, so not the actual guitarist for the album, but the guitarist in the movie was a guy called Glenn Hansard, who is and was at the time,
and he was the guy who invented the Australian political archiving system.
The archiving system.
He's the guy who writes down everything that everyone says in Parliament.
Little known fact, yeah.
And they have to insert it into him that way. I read that in Hansard.
Yeah. That joke might not fly either, to be honest.
I love having live editing. Live feedback. No, that's shit. No. Yeah. Terry Cotting continues holding up a 0 out of 10.
Yeah. So he was in a band, and in 1990 it would have been sort of quite large as well. He was in a band called The Frames, who very well-known Irish rock band, who pretty much, from the way it's been explained to me, is they are the powder finger of Ireland.
I thought U2 were the powder finger of Ireland.
No, everyone in Ireland hates U2. So if you meet an Irish person, particularly from Dublin, if you meet a Dubliner and you sort of mention Glenn Hansard or The Frames, you'll instantly be in their good books if they're in that, if they're that way inclined. Because you're referencing The Frames rather than U2. So
yeah. I suppose it's a bit like whenever somebody gets bigger than where they're from, everyone always thinks, fuck that wanker.
Yeah, exactly. So he went on. He was the guitarist in the movie, not so much on the album. I don't think he actually played on the album, but so he was in The Frames, he was in the movie. Then he actually went on 20 years later, I think it's 2007 it was, to star in another movie called Once, which was about, you know, an Irish busker who fell in love with this Czech singer, singer-songwriter, and they ended up getting this band together and, you know, falling in love and proving it really wrong about, you know, about their commitment to each other, and ended up releasing an album as well, the soundtrack to that album called Once, and that ended up winning the Oscar for the best soundtrack in 2007. So from that sort of commitments through the frames and into, you know, the guy acting in this movie in 2007 with another soundtrack called Once was it's a pretty cool little thread there, I think.
Yeah, that's cool.
And even better is another little thread from that is that one of the backup singers from the Commitments was like a massive fan of the Frames, thought they were completely underrated, should be, you know, worldwide stars. So she actually was in Pulp Fiction. She was the housemate of the drug dealer. She was sitting on the couch eating cereal, I think, when Marcellus Wallace's wife came in with a drug overdose, and she was wearing the Frames t-shirt to try and sort of boost their cred.
Tarantino would have loved that too, I suppose.
Yeah. It's a great
snorts little, another line and says, "Yeah, that's great. That's great."
So I thought that was a little, cool little thread there with all those three little soundtracks. I mean, obviously, Pulp Fiction won the big soundtrack as well. Yeah. So. Not one of mine, though. I didn't really like that soundtrack. I thought it was a bit naff.
We had a fantastic tweet from somebody who said they're I can't remember the handle. I don't have Twitter in front of me, but one of our listeners who said that their brother had been working at Target the day that the Pulp Fiction soundtrack came out, and he put it on the staff PA. And the problem is the opening dialogue on it is not what you want in a family store. And pretty soon after that was immediately cut off, and there was a sticker put on it saying not for in-store play. And I think that's probably – it's like people just don't like Dick Dale anymore. I don't know what the problem with people is. But
people are idiots.
Yes. Get more dick in your life.
So it's actually talking about getting more dick in your life. my third soundtrack is one from 1992, I think, maybe 93.
Chronological, these rather well.
I have chronological, because I can't really rank them. I don't really.
Well, that's kind of what I felt like. I was like, well, I'm going to put Spinal Tap at the top because it's a different beast entirely from a lot of these collections of songs that have been assembled to sell a movie. And you've got ones that are actually similar to Spinal Tap in that they are not just, you know, a collection of songs that work well. They are intrinsically part of the movie, and you can't have the movie without the soundtrack.
Yeah, no, exactly right, which is equally as true, even though the band itself wasn't on the third soundtrack, which is Singles from 1992.
Yes, I've had people who've raved about that fucking soundtrack.
It's a great soundtrack. I mean, the movie itself is pretty naff. It's a love song. It's a, you know, young man growing up through the world in a 1990s in Seattle, it was, obviously. And he's in a band, and the band was made up of Pearl Jam and Mudhoney, I think it was.
Yep.
And the soundtrack itself is made up of those sort of Seattle grunge sound of 1992. Yeah. So putting it in period, putting it in time, you've had, you know, the whole Nirvana thing happening in 1991.
Yeah.
For Pearl Jam itself, you had 10 released in 1991, and then a year after this was the single soundtrack.
And then Versus came out in 93, didn't it?
93, yeah. So on this soundtrack, there's actually two unreleased, well, not unreleased, but rare Pearl Jam songs that have never been on any other album. State of Love and Trust and Breathe, which are fucking huge songs. The fact they went on 10 was just a complete misstep on their part,
I think.
The fact
they had songs to give away, basically, at that point of their career, and the same's true of Nirvana, and they had so much creativity fucking oozing out of every pore that they could just give songs away to album soundtracks.
And they touched on back to the band that sort of started off Pearl Jam, which is Mother Love Bones. There was their big song, Chloe Dancer, was on that soundtrack as well. You've got Soundgarden, a couple of Soundgarden songs there. Chris Cornell solo, his first ever solo recording of a song called Seasons.
Mm.
And then sort of topping it off with Jimi Hendrix and the Smashing Pumpkins. And probably one that was, I guess the thing about these soundtracks is you always sort of pick it up going, okay, I'm going to buy it because it's the Pearl Jam songs. And, you know, being in 1992, you're a teenager, you're being a completist, you want to get everything they've ever released. So you pick it up, and the great thing about it is that you have all these other songs in there you've never fucking touched in ever. So Paul Westerberg is a guy that was the lead singer of The Replacements,
yep,
sort of a rocky sort of band, who decided to sort of get sober.
80s college rock kind of thing.
Yeah.
What the Americans, their term for indie rock, effectively.
Yeah, exactly. So he's gone off and become really poppy. And he's got these two really poppy songs in there called Dyslexic Heart and Waiting for Somebody, who, you know, both of those songs are just feel-good moments of the film. And Jimi Hendrix in there with a rare song called May This Be Love. But the song that sort of
stuck
out
to me was... Are You Experienced?
It is. But it's sort of towards the back, and it's not really a song that people touch.
No, it's kind of a dreamy, poppy kind of romantic song.
But the song that sort of picks it off for me is a band that it was introduced to me through this album that I've become a major fan of since then. It's called Screaming Trees.
I thought you were about to say the Screaming Jets, but yeah, the Screaming Trees. That's a fucking
Mark Lanegan.
Some Mark Lanegan band, isn't it? Yeah,
that real gravelly deep.
Yeah,
and since then it's become even more gravelly and deep with his various addictions.
Yes,
and experiences.
He's guested on a few things. I mean, recently-ish, I know he guested on that Ten Commandos album. Of course, he had his own album come out a year or two ago.
Yeah, and he does duets.
He sounded like gravel being poured into a weed thresher.
Yeah, bloody amazing guy.
Friend of the show, Dave from Drive Through Prod, is a massive Lanegan freak-out type, so I'm sure he'll appreciate the nod to that. But
I get it massively. It's not something I can really relate to, but
they had one particularly highly thought of, I suppose, Triple J song, didn't they? Was it I Nearly Lost You?
Yeah, Nearly Lost You, which was on the single soundtrack.
That was the one, That was, I think it was on the Hottest 100, the very, very first Hottest 100, Volume 1 CD.
Yeah, it would have been. This was 92, so it would have been around that time.
Good song.
It's a great song. So that was singles in 1992.
It is a great song.
And then, look, from there, I've actually got two really dear Australian albums that probably were forgotten. And actually, they are forgotten because you can't find the fucking CDs anywhere. They're not on streaming, as you mentioned last week. They're just sort of...
Well, yeah. I mean, this seems to be the thing. A lot of soundtracks aren't on there, but particularly the Australian fucking albums are just impossible to find.
So from a chronological point of view, the first one was the Young Einstein soundtrack.
Yes. Yeah.
It was that moment in time, wasn't it? That it was 1988, and it was when Australiana was realistically quite big.
It was the whole fucking bicentennial and expo in Brisbane and all that sort of stuff, for sure.
Yeah, and even more so, I mean, the way that it was being taken in the United States. There was a brief moment in time where Australiana was quite seriously a cultural phenomenon in the US.
Crocodile Dundee, those Koala Blue stores.
Since been taken the piss out of, quite rightly. but at the time, it was massive.
This is where I put in a link to the Simpsons episode about Australia.
Yeah, exactly. But this album, this is what not broke, but certainly solidified a couple of these bands to get still some continued support in the US, and that's mental as anything with the lead single, which is Rock and Roll Music.
Was that a Beatles cover? I think it was a cover of a song from the 60s. I don't know whether it was Beatles or somebody like that. Possibly Easy Beats.
Chuck Berry.
I knew it wasn't an original, and I knew it was from somewhere in the 60s, but I wasn't sure who it was by.
There you go. So mental as anything, and actually Yahoo Series himself did a cover of that too, so those two covers. The Saints was on there with a George Young, Vander and Young song called The Music Goes Round in My Head.
Yes.
Paul Kelly and the Coloured Girls is what...
Dumb Things. Amazing song, Dumb Things.
And Ice House, Great Southern Land. So those two...
That was the montage thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I think those three was the Paul Kelly, Ice House and Mentals, and that propelled those three bands to have a fairly solid college underground following in the US, which they still sort of have. I mean, Paul Kelly still tours that market. When Ice House sort of got back together a few years ago, they toured that market as well. Mentors have quite rightly fucked off.
because they're a million years old.
Yeah, a billion. They're still... Yeah. They were awful 20 years ago, so I can't believe what they'll be like now. So, but they're towards the back of that. I mean, look at this. There's looking at the album list now, and I've forgotten all these. But there was the Models, the Stems, and the Lime Spiders.
Yeah, that's fucking 80s Australian indie rock royalty, really.
Big time. And I didn't even know they were on there. Like they would, if I had, I did have this album when I was a kid, and I would have just turned it off. That would have been side two of the tape.
Yes.
And I would have just gone rewind.
This would have rewound the front up.
That was a great album.
We never had it so good.
No, exactly. So it was Young Einstein. The last one on my list is sort of well in the wheelhouse of my time and place, I guess, which is 1997, in a movie called Idiot Box.
David Caesar.
David Caesar, yeah, lead actor Ben Mendelsohn in one of his great roles as a
mad bogan. Jeremy Sims was the other half of that. I remember doing we had to do like general studies add-ons to our undergraduate degrees. Like we had to do a couple of units of weird shit in our undergraduate degree. So I did a few humanities things. Like I did a film studies thing. We did an Australian film unit, and I ended up doing this project on Idiot Box. So I know probably more about Idiot Box than anybody has any right to know about Idiot Box.
That's unfortunate because it's not a great
film. Not a good film at all.
I mean, there's some moments in it. I still like I think the lines that Ben Mendelsohn has, like the "get a dog after you."
David Caesar used to do used to be like a film reviewer on something. Did he have like a role in one of those Project Greenlight things? I remember thinking, sitting in judgment on stuff, and thinking, but all the movies you've made are kind of shit, and they're almost the same. Idiot Box, Mullet. I haven't actually seen Dirty Deeds, but I loved it. I do love the soundtrack of it, but money because it's Tim Rogers curated the whole bloody thing, so it's really a UMI album with a whole bunch of guest stars.
This is the Idiot Box soundtrack is UMI, so they've re-recorded, and this was back what you were saying last week. They actually went and recorded these songs for this album, and I think all of them did.
This was UMI 1997 too, which is when UMI were not trying to be the Black Crowes; they were trying to be UMI. Because by 2002, they were trying to be the Black Crowes.
So on this, they've got themselves. Obviously, they've got four or five songs of themselves that they've written and recorded for the movie. But they've also got the Mark of Cain, Snout, Magic Dirt.
The Mark of Cain, not Mark of Cain. I know that. I remember on Triple J they used to make this very clear because they said, you know, we're not Mark of Cain. We're not like Darren from Albury. We're the Mark of Cain.
Darren from Albury. The Mark of Cain, fucking evil band. So I remember seeing them at a dive bar in Brisbane sometime, and some prick behind me threw a beer bottle and it hit the drummer. Oof. And the drummer looked out in the crowd and saw me he's a big bastard, and it didn't end well that night. I left before the encore finished. I can assure you of that.
Yes, just to make sure that it wasn't going to be you who ended up picking splinters of stick out of your face.
So out of this, you got Mark of Cain, UMI with I think six songs from UMI, Crow as well.
No.
With the actor Peter Fenton, who ended up acting on another underground film a few years later as well. Snout.
You need some Snout.
Yeah, Snout's great. Snout are awesome. Ross McClellan as the lead singer. But interestingly, you've got Magic Dirt, only one song, but they re-recorded a song called My Pal, which is...
That's a G.O.D. song, isn't it?
Yeah. But even more curious is on the album, I'm just looking at this now, but on the album is... So God was this mythical Melbourne punk band of 1980-something.
Yeah.
I'm going to say even 79.
I actually mixed them up with... There was actually another band, a blues... I think it was an offshoot of, like, Chain. So there were all these Australian blues bands of, like, the late 70s, and one of them was called Guitar Overdrive. They also went by G.O.D. And when I was younger, I used to, like... These are clearly not the same band, because one of them just sounded like, you know, the blood and guts of a old blues band, and My Pal is not really that genre.
No.
If anything, it almost feels more fucking Dunedin sound.
Yeah, no, that song did, but the rest of the album wasn't that at all. It was some real crunchy shit. But they released one album, and they were notorious because they were very, very young. I think the guitarist was 15, maybe 14. And the singer, Joel Schilbersha, he was probably 16, 17 when it all came out, and they were fated as like the new punk, the new saints of Australia, but it all went pear-shaped. I think the guitarist, I could be getting this completely wrong, but the guitarist and the bass player ended up chopping himself or having an overdose or something fairly soon after that, and it all went sort of down the shit.
I understood they met a sticky ending, which is not the best.
But they've always been the touchstone of Australian punk and Australian sort of underground rock. If people sort of put it out there that they know My Pal, the song that they released, and G.O.D. or God, you know, you sort of know where they stand in their knowledge of Australian rock. So much so that when a fantastic Melbourne venue, The Tote, was going to close down a couple of years ago, it was actually closed, and they ended up resurrecting it pretty soon afterwards, but they closed it. It was, you know, it's been this centre of Australian or Melbourne punk music for 20-odd years. the song that, or the band that was closing it was The Drones, and they got Joel Shoebusher on stage, and they did a huge version of My Pal to close the tote.
That would have been something remarkable.
Yeah, the YouTube clips of that still sort of send shivers. It's just a bloke standing on the side of the stage just recording it, and it's a sight to behold. You can feel the sticky floor through the YouTube video. but Magic Dirt, yeah, Magic Dirt do a cover of that song on the Idiot Box soundtrack without Joel Shoebusher, but his other band, who he had a few dalliances with, Hoss, they actually recorded two songs for this album as well. And they covered The Saints' Simple Love as one of the songs that they recorded.
So that's good. So you've ended in 1997.
I've ended in 1997.
Which probably correlates with your music taste.
Well, no. I did have once in there from 2007, but it's sort of a bit... it's a hard soundtrack to listen to because it's very much of the movie. And, you know, the movie is about an acoustic singer-songwriter, busker, and a Czech piano player.
Which is, you know, which was the thing that's run through yours, which is it tends to be movies that are about music or movies that have music front and centre in the story. And you can't literally tell those stories without the music in them.
Yeah, and those sort of films don't really exist anymore, apart from the NAF ones that based on sort of American Idol type piss take movies,
Pitch Perfects and things like that.
Yeah, Pitch Perfect and all that sort of stuff, which is just not. I mean, that's just a joke. Something you'd watch and enjoy.
Basically, karaoke soundtrack.
Mm. What I do enjoy, I mean, soundtracks are weird. Like I haven't really gotten into them at all. Like I just don't find them that interesting. Like that obviously they're not around anymore. But back in the day, I just found them so
well. They might still be around. So this is the thing where I was talking to Adam about, and we were talking about separately. We were talking about the Black Panther soundtrack, and he brought up the Baby Driver soundtrack, which is another example of this art form we actually thought was probably dead. There's still people who can find a way to use it. And Bezo brought up the Atomic Blonde soundtrack, so there's still some places where it's still hanging in there.
I think there's a difference in my mind between a soundtrack and a score. Right?
Yeah,
I still listen to scores. Like I'll put, it depends on who it is. I mean, I'm not going to be a wanker and say I listen to every single score, but you know, I'll listen to the whatever Nick Cave puts his name to. So he'll do a film score and I'll listen to it ad nauseum. And there's a Sydney jazz trio called The Necks who always score films as well. So, you know, that sort of stuff I fucking love. And more just as a background stuff, though. I wouldn't put it on as something to entertain myself for an hour. But
people do all kinds of things to entertain themselves for an hour.
Exactly.
Like listening to this fucking podcast.
What I do enjoy, I mean, movie soundtracks have gone, but I think what has replaced it, particularly in my world, and I think certainly in popular culture, is gaming soundtracks. Not so much that you can buy on the shelf.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. That's a thing.
They're huge. I mean, especially like you got the franchise sort of games that come out every year. They are very much marked by their soundtrack.
Yeah.
And I can go back to sort of every FIFA for the last 10 years, probably not the last 10 years, but the last 5 or 6 years, and pinpoint which year that song came out in based on
which soundtrack it was in. Yeah.
And similarly, you've got the soundbox, the sandpit games that you can sort of drive around in a car for hours on end if you want to, and you can tune into radio stations in the car in the game, which are from a wide spectrum of genres. You know, you've got hip-hop stations, you've got rock stations, you've got indie stations, you've got classical stations.
So it's just huge immersive environment sort of.
Yeah, and you mark that they're unique enough that they're not songs you would hear in your day-to-day. You wouldn't hear them at shops, you wouldn't hear them, you know, on the radio, you wouldn't hear them on the TV ads.
The license you build for that must be enormous.
And probably different now, but I think bands, at least 5 years, probably 5 years ago, would sacrifice a lot to be on those soundtracks because it would break a band.
Well, like Guitar Hero, you know, it would tend to be the big name bands that would get on there. But I remember bands would pioneer that they'd exclusively release tracks to Guitar Hero,
and that's what happens with gaming. So you'll have bands that will get a song on a soundtrack as a way to, you know, replace the single as such.
Yeah.
And then base their marketing strategy off that game release.
Well, that's the marketing tie-in that used to be having the song on the soundtrack and having the film clip that was basically a recapitulation of the movie, and your song being part of the movie marketing people's toolkit of marketing goods.
Yeah.
And you were being promoted by them and they were being promoted by you.
I think there's two bands I can sort of pinpoint as being those leading albums for, particularly for the FIFA franchise. One was Block Party, and I can't remember which album it was, but there's that one song that absolutely speaks of FIFA, and it was the song that led the single for that album Root. The other one was MIA. She had a song on FIFA the year after, and that pushed that album from sort of a fairly middling, girly pop to something that was a bit more credibility and a bit more seriousness.
I suppose you have to think about the demographic of the game's players as well. I mean, although gaming is more diverse than people might think, it might give it credit for.
And it is changing now, and that's probably that's probably true for about 3 years ago. I think now gaming is very much an online environment, so you're battling on large world environments rather than running through a storyline and running through a...
And getting sledged by 12-year-old boys.
Yeah, so soundtracks aren't that important now, but they certainly were up until about 3 or 4 years ago.
Although it's still something that said the most popular game in the world at the moment is one of those completely non-online immersive games that you play in your own system. Yeah. And it's like that sort of stuff is what people tend to be... there might be a little bit of a backlash and a step away from that massively online environment. Although Fortnite isn't exactly small, so...
No. But no music in Fortnite, though.
No. Well, there's terrible background music in Fortnite.
And there's dance moves. So
yes.
Maybe soundtracks have been replaced by dance tracks.
Maybe that's the future. That's the terrible, terrible future that the children have brought upon us. That and Toto Africa. We can't let you go.
So but it brings it all back around to the fact that the kids are wrong.
The kids are always wrong.
Yeah, as we have.
But then again, so are the boomers and so are the Gen Xers, which brings us to, we couldn't let you go without getting you to throw in your comments on something that we've talked about a lot. You're not from Brisbane, but you're of Brisbane, just like myself and Bezo. What did you think of the final top five or so of Songs of Brisbane as voted for by people with no taste?
Yeah, I thought it was all right. I mean, that song is Brisbane for me.
It was going to be that anyway, wasn't it?
I think so. I think there's not much you can sort of change from people. And I think the band, I think Andrew did a great collation of quotes from the band this week in The Guardian about that song and about what it actually meant for the band as well, and trying to work out whether they thought the song was about Brisbane or not. And regardless of what they thought it was, the whole point of the Go-Betweens, the whole reason for their existence was a thing that Grant McLennan called the Striped Sunlight Sound, which is very much of Brisbane, that sort of striped sunlight afternoon in the late January, salad days, that never-ending fucking summer, where you're just lazy about the world, you don't care about anything. Back in the 80s, it would have been there was nothing to fucking do.
Yep.
And they filled that gap with that magical sound, which tied in beautifully with that vibe, and so from my perspective, it has to have been that song. I don't think there's any other song that could have met that that feel of Brisbane.
Well, I think they should have just picked the World Expo 88 advertising jingle, because that's the most Brisbane song I've ever heard in my life.
Well, what about wasn't it the other one?
Together We'll Show the World.
Yeah, but there was a Channel 7 one called Love Your Brisbane or something like that, that people still always refer to. So
it sounds more like a fucking... Well, the Australian Kitsch Twitter account was sharing a whole lot of incredibly bad, like the National Party election theme of 1982 or stuff like that. That was like... so that's something... That's not what it should have been. But anyway, well, congratulations on being the only person. You're not under 40, are you? So, I was going to say the only person under 40 who thinks that the Go-Betweens should have won. But
I think I would really like to think that people younger than me would think the same as well, because it sort of suggests. I think it's easier for people now to get in touch with the roots of their music, and I think that
I don't think people do though. You know,
they don't.
I think, no, because I always push this on. I mean, I can't even get Bezo to get in touch with the roots of music. Mm. I'm like, I've had to lead him by the nose through. Okay, this is metal. All the metal that you like, all the grunge that you like. Now, this is what this is what it was made from. It was made from Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, and this is what built it up. This is how we got to where we are.
And I think I don't think that people are that. They're not doing it willingly, but they can certainly see it. And I think that people can listen to the Go Betweens and they can hear, the John Peel singer, the John Steele singers, for example. They can hear
not the John Peel singers because he was on Radio One.
No. I don't know where that. Yeah, I don't know where that name come from.
No, John Peel was Radio One's legendary DJ from like.
Yeah,
from
but
the
60s I'm wondering on. whether the band actually named themselves that as a deliberate sort of callback to.
Was John Steele not involved?
I'm not sure.
Was Mumford and Son? Because nobody called Mumford is involved.
No, none of them were called John Steele.
Well, where does Vance Joy get off then?
Yeah, fucking. Why would you call yourself Vance?
I was just Pants Joy, which is like, look at my penis, because you know he's probably the only reason he got into the business was to get his dick out.
All the names to call yourselves, I mean, Jesus.
Like, well, I think all private schoolboys should be banned from music. They ruin everything. From them to the fucking Chats to,
The Chats, Jesus.
The Chats. They're one of those bands of private schoolboys who I call it doing bogan face, where you pretend that you're an ocker bogan, g'day, crikey dingo's fucking, good mate, and you're singing songs about going on smoke-o, and you're wearing a fucking surf life-saving cap, and it's like, fuck off, cunt.
Talking about that, though, Cosmic Psychos have just released a version of the VB ad.
which is the national anthem, I suppose. Yeah, how does it happen?
I think he goes, you can get it smoking a blunt.
Let me guess what he rhymes with that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they just released it this week, actually.
If I can find it, I'll put it in at the end of this to fade us out as we go.
Excellent.
Thanks for joining us. Really enjoyed your insights. And
that was my little. That end piece is my little love note to Bezo.
Yes, we'll make sure we turn it up and make sure everyone can do it. All right, thanks, mate, and we'll talk to everyone else next week.
No worries. Cheers, mate.
Cheers.